This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. And of course, we stream at the same time we broadcast at prairiepublic.org, and the show is archived there after the broadcast. And today, we're going to start our show with a discussion with Dr. Jerry Hatfield. He's the former director of the National Laboratory for Agriculture and the Environment. His PhD is in agricultural climatology and statistics, and he's going to be speaking in Bismarck at a farm and ranch conference at Bismarck State College next week. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Hatfield.
Oh, you're welcome. It's my pleasure. And it's looking forward to that conference next week. I think there's going to be a lot of exciting information, and being able to talk to producers and about, you know, how do we improve efficiency? How do we really begin to think about some of the challenges that face us in the future?
Let's talk first about the mission of the National Laboratory that you were so closely linked to for so long. You were a supervisory plant physiologist as well as directing the laboratory. What kind of research is conducted there?
If you think about the research that goes on in that laboratory, and as the name implies, it's National Laboratory for Agriculture and Environment, but we did a lot of work on the impact of agriculture on the environment, water quality, soil quality, air quality. And then we also did a lot of work on the reverse of that. What was the impact of the environment on agriculture? Looking at, you know, what are these changing weather patterns? What are the changing climate patterns? You know, how is that going to influence productivity? Because how plants and how cropping systems are influencing things like water quality really are somewhat dependent upon how the environment is influencing that agricultural production system. So we really built that lab as a transdisciplinary lab. It means we had a lot of different disciplines that went all the way from plant physiology to agriculture engineering to soil biogeochemistry, to soil science in terms of soil physics, agronomy, all those different disciplines, but we oriented those disciplines towards a problem to come up with solutions that would be viable for agriculture across the Midwest.
Well, you'll be talking about future directions and challenges for agriculture, which is a very interesting topic for a lot of people where we are. So in a nutshell, what will you be telling these people?
Well, in a nutshell, you know, when we start looking at the future challenges, obviously we've got a changing climate. The other piece of this puzzle is that we have an increasing population that's going to exceed 10 billion people by 2050. And if you look at this, weaving two things together, one is this increasing population, but at the other side of this is that our land base is also going to decrease because those 10 billion people are going to take more and more space. Mm-hmm. So we have a population that's going to take more land out of production. And then at the same time, we've also got this continued degradation of our soils because of erosion and some of the things we've been doing in agricultural practices. So our productivity per unit of land is going to have to increase. And so that becomes the challenge that we're going to have to face. How do we begin to improve our production efficiency as well as the whole production quality and quantity in all of this? So that becomes the broad emphasis of the future challenges as we go forward in agriculture.
Can you give us an example of some of the research that's being done to address the challenges created by climate change and what farming practices might have to be changed as well?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at farming practices and the future challenges out there, one of the things that we discovered is that And I've done a lot of work on this, and I'll talk about it in the talk in Bismarck, is yield gaps. And that's basically the difference between what we could potentially get if everything was optimum. We had optimum weather, we had all the optimum management, and then what we actually get. And that difference between those two is the yield gap. So I spent a lot of time over the past 10 years really looking at what causes that yield gap. And put it into a context of what we refer to as genetics by environment by management interactions. And think about it simply that management is what we oversee, and environment is what we're trying to overcome, because the Gen X are what we're trying to optimize. And if you look at, that's just farming in a nutshell.
That's 3D chess.
And you look at all this, but what we'd be doing is saying is, how does the yield gaps fit within this G by E by M concept that said, all right, what can we do for management, but what else can we do in terms of genetics? Are we choosing the right genetics? So we've spent a lot of time looking at how genetics respond to different environments, because in the yield gaps from a climate perspective, what we saw was that these yield gaps are a function of July maximum temperatures, because that really disrupts pollination, if you're talking about corn and soybeans. Mm-hmm. And it's August minimum temperatures, because the high nighttime temperatures during grain fill have a tremendous impact on the ability of that plant to efficiently produce grain. And then the other piece is soil water availability during the grain filling period. So we've got a temperature problem, and we've got a water problem. And if you look at yield variation within a field, is that a lot of that variation is caused by the lack of available water during the grain filling period. So we're trying to bring all those pieces together to say, how do you begin to go forward in terms of management practices that can improve that soil's ability to hold water and make it available, that crop? But then how do you begin to select the genetics that go with that? And saying, if we look at this puzzle from a different perspective, how do we maybe look at a shorter season hybrid? And I'll just use that example in corn, that it captures its yield potential before it runs out of water late into the growing season. And we've done things on wheat as well that would be of interest to, North Dakota, South Dakota, looking at how wheat yield gaps also are changing relative to the changing climate.
Dr. Jerry Hatfield is the former director of the National Laboratory for Agriculture and the Environment in Ames, Iowa. And he'll be speaking next week at a conference in Bismarck, which is titled Discover the Bottom Line, Economics, Ecology, and Sociology, aimed at farmers and ranchers and interested people. So you mentioned water. It's a vital resource for agriculture and everyone. What is the research to significantly conserve water needed for farming and ranching?
Well, if you look at it, one of the biggest challenges that we have going forward is going to be water management. How do we capture what rainfall we have? Because we exist across the upper Midwest and the upper Great Plains on rainfall. And so how do we capture that? How do we store it within the soil? How do we prevent it from running off? And if you think about one major conservation practice that goes with that is the use of reduced tillage, keeping that residue on the surface. Because not only does it protect that soil surface from the raindrop energy so we can absorb more water, but we also prevent it from being evaporated from the surface back into the atmosphere so the plant can use more of that. So we see that as one of the major things that we could do in terms of conservation of water. And if we begin to think about then slowly improving that soil in terms of diverse rotations or cover crops or all of this, then we can begin to improve that soil and increase its water holding capacity as well. So all of those things are, as I tell producers, I said, farming is not rocket science. Farming is much more complex.
Yes.
Because we got a lot of interacting things going on, and you just can't pick one piece out and say, here's my silver bullet that's going to solve all my problems, because it's not a silver bullet. It is basically one thing affects another, and we look at all these different pieces that are going on, and so we really have a very complex set of opportunities to think about how they all fit together, but then respond in terms of what we do in terms of a management change. And in reality, there's no such thing as a simple management change. they really are complex in how they impact a lot of the different pieces that are going on.
Well, water, as I mentioned, is needed by everybody, and there is concern about various industrial practices, whether it's commercial farming or oil production, extraction, about what is used on the farm that might leach into the soil and get into groundwater and wells. And I think in agricultural states, there is ongoing discoveries, I think, of certain farm chemicals showing up in groundwater. So what can be done to limit the loss of potable water?
Well, one of the things that we can do to reduce the loss of potable water is really improving the capacity of that soil to hold water. Because if we improve the organic matter, we improve its capacity to store water. But at the same time, you improve that organic matter content, you also improve the ability of that soil to degrade a lot of the chemicals that are put on. The soil becomes a very, very good filter. If you think about some of the herbicides that are put on, there's populations of bacteria that will degrade those. And the slower we can make that chemical move through the soil, the greater the chance of it being degraded. So we can solve a lot of problems that way. And the other case is really to think about how we manage those chemicals relative to the water dynamics within that soil. And just give you an example, I mean, we see a lot of cases where we have runoff of herbicides because they're applied when there's a chance of rain. You know, then there's a probability that they're going to run off. So if we wait until after that rain event before we put a herbicide on, then we don't see that runoff. The other piece is to make sure that we're using as low rates as possible to achieve the control that we want, you know, so we're not putting excess into the environment. The same thing applies for nutrients as well as herbicides. So that's part of this overall management that I believe that we really need to discover how all these linkages are occurring among components of the system.
There's been an ongoing controversy over the safety of handling some ag chemicals like glyphosate and drift concerns about another chemical, dicamba, for example, or for that matter, glyphosate. What's your take on this?
Well, I think if you look at things like glyphosate, we need to understand more of how that chemical is reacting in the environment. We know that it has a lot of impact on our soil biology. We know a lot of things like some of the fungicides, the neonics even are having an impact on the soil biology. And one of the things that we understand is that if we want to improve our soil, that we've got to create a very effective soil biological system in there. And a lot of the things that we apply chemically don't allow that to happen. So we need to really think judiciously about how this is used, you know, just from anything that's applied, knowing glyphosate, atrazine, all the other chemicals that we've applied over time, and how those all fit together. The other piece of this, you talk about dicamba in terms of drift, is understanding why and how that the mechanisms of that drift is occurring, maybe really restrict the times in which it's applied, but also understanding the atmospheric conditions that allow that drift to occur. So these are just some of the complexities of problems that become challenges for us.
Well, you mentioned how complex farming has always been, sometimes a kind of a roll of the dice, but less so, I guess, as we try to improve the technology around it. And there is significant technology development around ag these days, like remote sensing, artificial intelligence, automation, those kinds of things. How do you see that changing the way these operations do their business?
Oh, I see that we're on the cusp of what I term a revolution in agriculture, and that revolution is really built around our ability to utilize the data that we have available to us into an information stream that allows for more timely decisions that impact what we're doing in terms of all this process. And I'll just give an example of this relative to remote sensing and its linkage with artificial intelligence, because we have a lot of capabilities with drones and fixed-wing aircraft and satellites. I mean, we collect a lot of data that is applicable to decision-making on farms. And what we've been looking at is if we take that information and link it with observations of the plant, we've been taking it through an artificial intelligence process, and it's been coming up with different relationships in terms of some of these dynamics than what we've been using in the past. And I think that's an example of that maybe we start looking at this and saying, how do we, and then one of the things we looked at was, could we pick tasseling up on corn? Can we pick a heading up on wheat? Because we always think about managing that crop differently in the vegetative stage and then managing it differently in the reproductive stage. Well, in order to do that, you have to determine when that is occurring. You know, if you're walking in a field, you see that, but if you're using remote sensing, you've got to come up with some indicators. So we've been finding that there are techniques that we can use that help us differentiate that very, very nicely. And that will put us into a path of how do we take data and make it into information? Because I've always said that agriculture is and farming is data rich at times, but information poor. And I think that's one of our biggest challenges, Doug, as we go forward, is how do we create a better flow of information that can help producers make decisions about what's going on in their fields, what's going on in their farms, and putting into a timely basis for a growing season, but also begin to think about not only that field in one growing season, but that field across multiple growing seasons to say, are we doing the best thing within that field? And can we use different endpoints, and not only productivity, going back to this thing in terms of water quality, improving our soils, all of those things simultaneously.
Well, you mentioned improving soils, and there's this sort of movement out there toward sustainable agriculture. It's not necessarily at loggerheads with traditional commodity farming, but it's different. Do you think that small farm or the organic movement will continue to grow? Is there space for smaller operators to, you know, make a living?
Oh yeah, I think there's a space for smaller producers to make a living. I think some of those principles that we talk about for organic in terms of improving the soil, focusing on the soil, are extremely applicable to larger operations, because what we see is we take those principles of soil improvement, we find out that they're more water use efficient, they're more nutrient use efficient, so we're getting more return on the investment of either water or nutrients, but they're also more resilient to all the weather variation that's going on. Because they have water available, they're no longer as dependent upon having that timely rainfall in say, July and August. They are able to buffer that a lot differently. And so I think a lot of these principles don't really have a size restriction to them. It's a matter of what capabilities those producers have to be able to implement some of these practices.
Well, as you know, in Iowa and lots of Midwest places, and in North Dakota, the trade issue over soybeans was a big hit, and that resulted in lots of storage being added to farms. How would you characterize the current state of research into storing and transporting commodities?
Well, I think that this is, again, one of our challenges. I mean, if you look at going back to this capability of feeding this 10 billion people, you know, we talk about there's always big concern about food waste in there. But I think the other piece of this is how do we store this grain so that it maintains its quality, that it maintains all that integrity. And I think that we need to continue to focus on proper storage, proper post-harvest management that preserves all the quality of that grain as well. And I think this is another area that we need to be focusing on.
Let's get back to your area and climate as well. We are looking at a world that is warming, and methane is back in the news now as a greenhouse gas that's particularly pernicious, more so than even carbon dioxide. How might farmers and ranchers consider the potential for alternative energies like solar and wind to lower their production costs and, you know, maybe with improvements in the grid and net metering really effectively reduce that expense?
Well, I think that, you know, I think all the alternative energies, you got solar, you got wind. How do we look at those? Iowa is now, I think, number two in the United States in terms of wind energy, electricity generated from wind energy. You know, across the upper Midwest, you know, we know we've got lots of wind. And so how do we capture that effectively? But I think you raised the interesting question is, how do we put that into the grid effectively? How do we look at the efficiency and return on investment of some of this in terms of, you know, how long does it take to return on solar panels? How long does it take to return on wind energy? I think the other piece of this is really looking at energy conservation on the farm. If you look at our carbon footprint, can we reduce that in farms because of maybe reducing our intensity of tillage, reducing our intensity of how many nutrients we apply because there's a large carbon footprint that go with nitrogen and phosphorus and all the other chemicals that we put on. How do we really look at that from a different standpoint to say, how can we bring this together to have a different view of agriculture from a carbon perspective and from a carbon footprint perspective? And the other piece of this is not only the carbon footprint, but let's think about the carbon footprint. Let's think about the water footprint of agriculture. Let's think about the energy footprint of agriculture. Bring those three things together. I just thought I'd add some more complexity to our problem. But looking at all of those things simultaneously, because that's really what agriculture is about. So we're in a business of capturing carbon. We're using water to get there, you know, as we the whole photosynthetic process, but we also have a lot of energy going into that system as well.
So there's lots of changes coming to the agricultural and farming and ranching industry, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, we're looking at, I think if you look at agriculture, it is a complex problem, and I think we have a lot of opportunities to look at changes across there, but I think we need to understand some of the dynamics of how these pieces are interacting with each other so that we continue to improve this, that we don't create a problem and then have to solve that problem, but we take a much more judicious approach to saying, as we understand this, then we can begin to figure out how to really begin to optimize that system even more effectively.
Dr. Jerry Hatfield is the former director of the National Laboratory for Agriculture and the Environment. He'll be speaking next week at a conference at Bismarck State College, February 25th and 26th. If you want to find out more about that, just Google Farming for the Bottom Line and choose the Eventbrite link. There is no cost, but you are asked to register for this. Dr. Hatfield, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
Coming up on Main Street, a story from Harvest Public Media. And Sue Balcom tells us about designer fruits. First, the news.
From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald. The Minot City Council has decided to appeal FEMA's decision to change the flood maps for the city, a change that could force more Minot residents to buy flood insurance. Minot Mayor Sean Sipma says originally, FEMA's flood maps used a 5,000 cubic foot per second flow, which he says is essentially the Mouse River flow. But he says FEMA has changed its hydrology, so it now uses a 10,000 CFS flow rate.
And that puts the footprint pretty close to what it was in 2011, maybe not in depth, but footprint-wise.
That 2011 flood was the flood of record. SIPMA says city officials believe FEMA did not accurately calculate the amount of water the upstream dams can hold back. And he says 2011 was not a 100-year event. It was much worse.
Our argument is that we firmly believe it's 8,000 CFS, which does shrink that footprint and also reduces the depth in some areas, which would make a difference for homeowners in the valley, for the city as a whole, for the impact of what flood insurance rates would be.
SEPMA says FEMA's decision would affect virtually all of the Minot community.
Because as flood insurance rates go up, values on those property inversely go down. And if we have a constant cost for city services, inevitably then we would have a mill levy adjustment throughout the community that would then impact everyone. The other aspect is that's millions of dollars leaving the community, going to the NFIP. And while we arguably say very strongly that flood insurance is important to have, as those costs go up, more money leaves the community.
SEPMA says it will likely cost the city $250,000 to appeal the decision. He says this could be a precedent setter because he's unaware of any other community who's taken this step. After a very slow start, the number of people who have received their Real ID driver's license in North Dakota has taken off in the past several months. Brad Schaefer heads the North Dakota Department of Transportation Driver's License Division.
In January, we were at 65% of the people coming in to receive a credential were getting the Real ID, which was our highest number to date. Currently, we're at about 22% of all drivers and ID holders in North Dakota have the Real ID. So I think, you know, we're expecting that number to, you know, grow quite a bit over the next, you know, leading into October.
Starting October 1st, drivers without the Real ID will not be able to use their standard driver's license or ID card to board domestic flights or enter federal facilities. The North Dakota DOT issues about 633,000 driver's license and permits. In order to make it easier to get a Real ID, the State Department of Transportation has launched Drive ND, a program to improve customer service and cut wait times at many driver's license bureaus statewide. And private Minnesota businesses who hang "This is a gun-free zone" sign in their windows could be held liable should an intruder harm patrons inside under new legislation being shopped around. Minnesota State Representative Jeremy Munson says such signs portray a false sense of security and could lead to law-abiding citizens being targeted. Munson says the penalty would be left up to the courts. The measure has been referred to the House Public Safety Division. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Over 13 million American households get their drinking water from private wells. Yesterday, we heard a Harvest Public Media report about contamination involving those wells. Private wells don't have testing requirements for water quality, meaning that dangerous contamination can go unchecked. Today, Harvest Public Media's Christina Stella reports that blind spot led to a push in rural communities to test private wells.
It's first period at Freeman High in the southeastern town of Adams, Nebraska. A handful of seniors from the school's Future Farmers of America Club huddle around a spread of plastic bottles and little glass test tubes. Addison Dorn braved the Midwestern cold the night before to collect water samples from her family's well. In a minute, they'll test it for contamination, like too many nitrates.
Yeah, it usually gets in well water around here because of fertilizers. Nitrogen is found in fertilizers, and so when there's like a lot of rain or irrigation, it can sometimes seep into your groundwater, which will go into your well.
Polluted waters put many rural communities at risk for long-term health complications like cancer, birth defects. A 2018 National Institute of Health study suggested about a quarter of wells in agricultural communities aren't safe to drink from because of high nitrate levels. That's partly why Tony Jensen, Freeman's agriculture teacher and FFA sponsor, enrolled the school in the University of Nebraska-Lincoln's Know Your Well program.
I don't think a lot of people realize that you should get tested as often as you should. And, you know, so it's kind of also that educational component for the community.
The Citizen Science Program places scientists in classrooms across the state to teach young people how to spot unsafe drinking water. Mary Skopek, who runs the University of Iowa's Lakeside Laboratory, says citizen science was historically for people privileged enough to do it as a hobby. Think Sir Isaac Newton or Charles Darwin.
But I'd say within the last 20 years, for sure, there's been this strong upswing in folks that wouldn't identify themselves as scientists, who care about the environment.
She supervised a similar program in Iowa for 10 years, which trained the public to test local streams and creeks. At its peak, Scopec's team had 5,000 volunteers.
After a few years, word of mouth was so strong that we didn't have to advertise at all.
Harry Heifer, who lives just south of Lincoln, has volunteered for a few well testing programs over the years. He says ag communities play a critical role in testing their water quality.
I think the concept of it is great because, you know, government can't go out there and test every well and get information from it. And even now, the city county health department likely has records when the well's first put in, but after that, there's no record of what happens to the water.
Heifer has watched his nitrate levels climb up to 18 parts per million over the years. He eventually warned his neighbors, some of whom have young children. That's exactly the kind of conversation the Know Your Well program hopes for, by teaching younger people to be aware of water issues. Back at Freeman High, Addison's friend Rayanne shows her how to mix the well water with a reactant in a sample tube. The pinker it turns, the higher the nitrate content.
And then you just let it sit, and then color development will happen over time.
So this is pretty easy.
Yeah.
A few minutes later, the group is surprised to see the tube turn cotton candy pink.
We have a lot of nitrate, what we found out.
High levels.
Yeah, high levels of nitrate, like 10 to 14.
Thankfully, Dorn won't be drinking from that well. It's used for irrigation. But Scopec thinks discoveries like these are important, especially in a classroom setting, because they reinforce trust in the scientific process. She's also found that communities are less likely to discuss solutions, like working to use fertilizer more precisely or installing a home filtration system, if they can't see for themselves that they have a problem.
And I think that's really, really powerful because most people hated science when they went through it in school because they saw it as a test, right or wrong answer, as opposed to a process of gathering and understanding information.
In Scopec's view, a pink test tube doesn't have to feel like a gotcha moment. It can just as easily be the start of a life-saving conversation. For NET News, I'm Christina Stella.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration that focuses on farm and rural issues. Next on our show, Main Street Eats with Sue Balcom.
Theater NDSU, in collaboration with NDSU's Chaley School of Music, is proud to present Into the Woods for one weekend only, February 27th through the 29th at 7:30 p.m. and March 2nd at 2 p.m. in Festival Concert Hall. The musical reimagines classic fairy tales and reveals a moral for all eras. More information is available at 701-231-7969.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and joining me from our Bismarck studio is Sue Balcom from the Root Cellars Farm outside of Mandan, because it is time for another installment of Main Street Eats. Sue, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. There's nothing I like better to do than talk about food.
And especially at this time of year, and, you know, there's only so much that you can convince yourself that the snow is beautiful before you start to think about fruit and wanting to eat it fresh.
And don't
fruit
you
now.
Kind of feel that craving? I have been craving fresh vegetables and fruits. I eat salad almost every day for lunch because it's like all of a sudden my body's like, after Christmas and all the heavy food we eat there, it's like, oh, come on, we got to get something healthy in your gut. And so I happened upon some, like walking around in the stores, you will see such a variety of bizarre and unusual fruits and vegetables anymore.
Well, and in some cases, you'll see them and it's a case of transportation levels have improved, and so we're getting fruits from far from here. But then in some cases, these are ones that we are, like, making, essentially. You call them designer fruits.
Right. They make designer jeans. Why not designer fruits so you can fit in your designer jeans?
But with the designer jeans, we're not breeding two different kinds of jeans together.
That's true. We aren't. There's a lot of hybrid seed out there. And a lot of people are confused about what hybridization is versus genetically modified organisms.
Okay.
So what you're doing when you're breeding something, it would be like, I always use this example with the kids. If you take Mr. Tomato and Mrs. Tomato, and Mrs. Tomato comes from a different part of the country. Let's say she's a black crim, and Mr. Tomato is aroma. and you marry the two of them, they're going to have another tomato, you know. And so when you're breeding things, it happens naturally out there. Like if you have two or three kinds of squash planted in your garden and your honeybees come along and they get in those flowers, which are very important to the process of hybrid vegetables and fruits, you got to have that flower in there because that's how that reproduces. But if your bee is over here on this plant and gets all covered up with pollen and then goes over to another plant's flower and drops some of that pollen in there, those two species actually mix. Okay. And scientists have found a way to control that. It's not easy to control because you never know which is the dominant plant, but they're working on these hybrid fruits and vegetables, and they're always kind of a related family, and they create an offspring, quote unquote, that has qualities taken from both parents. Now, when you're talking about genetically modified organisms, you're talking about taking a fish and a tomato and them getting married at the very level of their DNA. You know, it has to be forced. You can't do it naturally. It has to be done in a lab.
In a lab. I always get the weirdest visuals when I'm interviewing you. So.
Well, but, you know, what it really amounts to. And so I don't usually buy things that are genetically modified because of my personal beliefs about that. But I certainly love these designer fruits. And the newest one, is this Cosmic Crisp apple that they've been working on in Washington State for a long, long time. Because, as you know, it takes a long time to grow a tree. It was finally released just this year.
So what's it got going for it?
It is actually a really pretty fruit. It is called Cosmic Crisp because it has bright yellow dots on its little red skin. It was developed by Washington State University, so they still have the rights to sell it. But it is kind of a honey crisp crossed with another variety of apple, and so they're supposed to be like extremely tasty. They actually call it a game changer.
Ooh.
And I cannot wait to try it. I'm going to go out and look for it. Oh, I do too. Honeycrisp are the best. And you know that it does help, like if you're growing your own apple trees, to have more than one so that your bees can cross-pollinate them, because sometimes that's what it takes for a tree to be healthy. But what they do to promote the right genes or the right parent plant to come out is they actually graft apple trees to a basic, sturdy, hardy apple tree. They'll take the branches from the tree they want to breed, and they'll actually graft those on there. So then the tree is really healthy already, and then they'll get the product that they want out of the deal.
All right, what's a tanger or tangor?
Oh, jeez. It's one of those kind of crazy things between a sweet orange and a mandarin orange. So I would imagine I've never seen one, a little smaller than orange, but it has more vitamin C than a traditional tangerine. Oh, that's what it is. It's a tangerine and an orange, okay. Which I don't know why you'd want to blend those two together in the first place because they're so similar. But they say that they're really tasty. And, you know, it's one of the things I look for when I'm buying fruit is the small ones that I can eat in one sitting so that I don't have to, like, use a knife or throw part of it away. So I like the idea of those little tiny – what are those little tiny oranges called that the kids eat?
It'll come to me as soon as we get off.
As soon as, right, yeah, right. And then as you're walking around in the store, you're going to see, you know, ugly fruit, U-G-L-I, that they really are ugly and they're big and I wouldn't even be able to tell you how to eat one. But, you know, if you're adventuresome, you should go out there and try things.
Well, how about the jostaberry? Am I getting that right?
Jostaberry. Doesn't that sound good?
It does.
Oh, it's a blackberry combination, a blackberry type berry, which is a combination of a currant and a gooseberry. And I love gooseberries. These are big berries. I like blackberries because I can eat like a whole, mm-hmm. like a whole, not a pint, but a whole big bin of blackberries in one sitting. I love them so much. But these kind of also have a little bit of kiwi, blueberry, and grape undertones to them. Mm. And don't ask me how they ever come up with this stuff. I would imagine that, and this would be a good job to have, being a taste tester for new fruit. Like, whoa, yeah, I really like this. This one tastes a little bit like, and gooseberries are my favorite berry to grow, so...
Sounds delicious. Okay, you have another one on here. Rabbage?
Oh,
what is rabbage?
This, I got to look for rabbage, man. I love the word. The rabbage is kind
of fun. It does seem fun. Yeah, I totally want to eat this.
It's a combination of radish and cabbage. And as you know, cabbages are really good for you, but radishes are spicy. And so you've kind of got a spicy lettuce type leafy green that has the qualities of cabbage in it too. So I would imagine that you could eat it raw, you could put it in a smoothie, and you could do a little bit of stir fry.
I was going to say, this is going to take your kimchi, like, next level.
Oh, I never even thought of that. Let's go for that microbiome fermentation-type wonderful sauerkraut. Yes, that's absolutely wonderful. You know, one of the things we eat when we're at work, we go to the grocery store, and they have things in a bag, like a salad kit. And one day I took it apart and inspected every ingredient in there. And so now I'll go to the store and I'll buy whatever three kinds of cabbage I can find and some romaine lettuce and grind all that stuff up and put it in the fridge. And you can eat it as a salad or you can stir fry it. And so this is definitely going on my salad list for sure.
Mm. Another hybrid here, the wineberry.
Oh, doesn't that sound good? But yeah. It doesn't come in a box. You can't pour it out of a box in your refrigerator. But it's similar to a raspberry. It has lots of vitamin C and antioxidants. Good for your liver and heart. And they can be made into jams, like a good raspberry jam, of course. Or you can make wine out of them.
With a wineberry?
With a wineberry. Wouldn't that be fun? But yeah, I would definitely tell people to get out there, and if you don't know what to do or how to peel something, there's two avenues you can take. One, talk to your friendly produce manager at your local store. They would be more than happy to instruct you as to how to open up an ugly fruit. You might need a machete, though. I've seen some pretty big ugly fruits.
Sweet.
Or, you know, YouTube has a lot of videos. So every time I buy a pomegranate, I go in and look at the YouTube video that shows you how to cut it so it comes out in sections. And I sure wish that whoever invented the pomegranate would have, like, gone more fruit and less seeds in there.
Those are really good. The areoles, like,
I eat the whole thing. And, yes.
Yeah, but they are a little hard to get at.
And some people that are getting older in our family don't like to have to chew that much to get something out of their meal. So yes, go out and get some fruit and look for those apples. They're I can't wait to see what they look like, and I can't wait to taste them. An apple a day keeps the doctor away.
Thank you, Sue.
Thank you, Ashley.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by AARP North Dakota. Providing caregiving resources, healthy living information, tips for families to avoid scams, and connecting with communities at fun events. They're creating real possibilities here in North Dakota. AARP.org/ND.
Well, the weather's warming up. The weekend is looming. It's time for Christine McClellan and I to look at the calendar of stuff to do.
Yes. All right. So we have the Solar System Explorers series. This is a series that the MSUM Planetarium has been doing. And this weekend they're doing Rocky Planets. So it's Saturday and Sunday, the 22nd and 23rd. Again, that's at the MSUM Planetarium in Moorhead. You can visit the rocky planets in our solar system, starting with the planet closest to our star, Mercury. And the show also tours Venus, stops and take a look at our own Earth, and ends up on Mars. So Saturday at 10 a.m. is the Twinkle Tot session. That's 2 to 5 years old. And then Sunday at 3 p.m. is the Space Cadet session, which is ages 6 through 10. And tickets range from $5 to $8.
The Kix Band Winter Concert is Fargo at First Lutheran Church's Celebration Hall. That's on Sunday from 3 to 4:30. It features outstanding musicians from the Fargo-Moorhead area, and this is a really good band. These are great musicians. The tickets for adults, $15, students, $8, 10 years and younger are free. It's kid and family friendly, so it's open to all ages. Again, it's the Kix Band Winter Concert, Fargo at the First Lutheran Church, Sunday from 3 to 4:30.
The Fargo-Moorhead Comic Con is happening this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, February 22nd and 23rd. This is going to be at the Ramada in Fargo. It's a celebration of comics and popular culture in all media. Highlights include local and regional vendors of all things comics, and there's also some costume contests for kids and adults. So Saturday, it starts at 10 a.m. and goes until late in the evening, and Sunday, it goes from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Tickets range from $5 to $8 for daytime admission, and there's a family day pass available for $20.
Well, let's get out of town. Sensational Sundays, the Prairie Post Office in Bismarck on Sunday. You can join them for a presentation and book signing by K. Amy Phillips and Stephen R. Bolduc. The presentation will include a brief history of mail delivery in Dakota Territory and highlight the critical roles of post offices in contemporary rural North Dakota communities. It's Sunday from 2 to 3. It's free. Sensational Sundays, the Prairie Post Office.
Out Loud at the James is happening at the James Memorial Art Center in Williston on Friday, February 21st. All stage performers are invited to bring your musical instruments, poems, magic tricks, songs, stories, jokes, or any other talent that you would like to share with a welcoming crowd of your neighbors and friends. It's held downstairs at the James Memorial Arts Center in the center stage in Williston. It starts at 8 p.m. on Friday, goes until 10 p.m., and it's free to attend.
It is warming up this weekend. Actually,
yes.
Pretty nice temperatures for this time of year, so consider the candlelight ski at Maplewood State Park near Pelican Rapids, Minnesota. It's a Saturday from 5:30 to 8:30. You can walk, ski, or snowshoe by candlelight. Drop by any time between 5:30 and 8:30. The stars will be twinkling overhead, perhaps, if clouds allow that. Candles will be flickering on the snow regardless. After exploring the trails, you can warm up around a crackling fire and roast marshmallows, enjoy hot chili, bars, and a hot beverage. For more information, contact Maplewood State Park. That's the Candlelight Ski, Saturday from 5:30 to 8:30.
The Dakota Resource Council is presenting Right to Harm, a film and conversation about CAFOs. This is going to be at the Downtown Fargo Library, the Dr. James Carlson Public Library, on Sunday, February 23rd. This is a documentary film that exposes the public health impact that factory farming has on many rural communities across the United States. And after the screening of the film, a discussion will be held with North Dakota citizens that have been affected by CAFOs, which stands for Concentrated Animal Feeding Operations. So the documentary starts at 2 p.m. Again, that's at the Downtown Fargo Library, and it's free.
A children's book event at the farm celebrating National Tell a Fairy Tale Day. This is Fargo on Saturday. Fargo Antiques and Repurpose Market is prepping for National Tell a Fairy Tale Day by stocking up on antique and vintage children's books and by hosting a children's book signing event. On February 22nd, from noon until 4, they'll have four local North Dakota children's book authors in the shop signing books. Again, it's Saturday from noon until 4. It's at the Fargo Antiques and Repurposed Market. That's in far south Fargo. What's your choice this week?
My pick is the Unglued Craft Festival. This is an annual festival that they have. It's at the Plains Art Museum in Fargo. It's going on Friday and Saturday, the 21st and 22nd. This is an indie craft fair and bazaar that brings back traditional crafting techniques with a fresh new flair and lots of Midwest love. You can purchase from local crafters, artists, DIYers. And during the event, there are also some free workshops to have fun learning how to do various crafts. So Friday, it is a ticketed event from 5 to 9 p.m., $15 per ticket in advance or $25 the day of. And Saturday, it's a free event. Go and buy from these local crafters. It's 9 a.m. to 4 p.m.
My pick is the Sleepy Hollow Presents Make Your Own Kind of Music, music from 1964 to 1975. I kind of remember that. It runs Thursday through Saturday, February 20th through the 22nd, and then next Thursday through Saturday as well at 1603 Main Events in Bismarck. It's an adult show. It features pop rock music from 64 to 75. So take it in from 6 to 9:30 p.m. again Thursday through Saturday this week and next. Tickets start at $30, and it supports Sleepy Hollow Theater in Bismarck. And if you have an event that you'd like to hear on Main Street, let us know. Send us an email at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org. That's what's happening.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 20th. Vague fears of nuclear war can lurk like green monsters hiding under the bed. After Russia built atomic bombs in 1949, fears of nuclear war led to fallout shelters and civil defense brochures entitled Survival in a Nuclear Attack. By the 1960s, NORAD radars watched for Russian bombers and later even missiles. If war began, the president would activate the emergency broadcast system, which could interrupt regular TV and radio programs for vital civil defense information. Radio and television stations regularly broadcasted test warnings, opening with an urgent attention signal, followed by the words, "This is a test." That was how it was supposed to work. However, on this date in 1971, Les Maupin, broadcaster at Minot's KLPM radio, was startled to find this message on the Associated Press teletype ticker. "This is an emergency action notification directed by the president. Normal broadcasting will cease immediately. Message authenticator, hatefulness/hatefulness. Immediately, KLPM and specially designated stations across the country stayed on the air while other stations went silent. For breathless minutes, Minot citizens looked skyward for impending doom, knowing the Minot Air Force Base was a likely target only 15 miles from town. One citizen said, 'My heart just stopped. I thought the bomb was coming.' Relief came when a second emergency bulletin appeared on the Associated Press ticker. Cancel message sent at 0933. Repeat, cancel. Authenticator, impish/impish. What in the world had happened? Investigators discovered that W.S. Eberhardt, who was on duty at the National Warning Center, inadvertently blundered by grabbing the actual warning tape for the teletype rather than the typical test tape. Usually, only the White House can order release of such an emergency notification. Therefore, President Richard Nixon ordered an investigation of the dangerous flub. Investigators instructed the National Warning Center to place the actual warning tape inside a desk drawer 5 feet from the transmitter rather than right next to the test tape. It was a long 18 minutes for North Dakota radio listeners who feared that nuclear annihilation might be imminent. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Steve Hoffbeck. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Friday on Main Street, North Dakota Native Vote is a new organization dedicated to increasing civic engagement for Native communities. On our show tomorrow, we'll discuss the issue with Executive Director Nicole Donaghy and Board Member Wes Davis. Tom Eason will share another Plainsfolk essay about lightning rod salesmen. News Director Dave Thompson will offer his analysis of the week's big stories, and Matt O'Lean will review Uncut Gems. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.